having been to a number of conferences and camping sessions and doings, I realize that at this time of the week, we've had a number of meetings, there have been seminars, we've had rain in the camp, many of us have been up late, we can't get the zippers shut on our sleeping bags, cold drafts keep us half awake all night, and visits to the bushes, and I realize that most of us have dragged ourselves in here half exhausted tonight. As I was sitting back here preparing for the ministry of the evening, thank you, I thought, boy, these people take a long time to get to the actual word, don't they? It's past 9:30, these people are half asleep. I tell you, though, I had already come prepared tonight, really, to do all the work for you. We've had a number of messages that have kind of called for a response from us, and I feel in many ways that the work of the week thus far has been shared equally by the musicians, the men and women on the platform, and those of you who have come to fill these grossly uncomfortable seats. Night after night. So, what I'm preparing to do is to just want you to relax and enjoy this message tonight. There is a bit of a challenge to it, but I'll put that to you myself. I'm not convinced that masses of you will want to team forward afterwards, but I really just want you to enjoy this. It is not a piece of drama. It's not Rudyard Kipling. It's the Bible, my style. And all I really ask of you is to settle back and be comfortable. If you have to move around a bit to find an extra comfortable position, please do that. I am going to ask, however, that you put the lights down out there because it's just really, most of them haven't bathed in the last 3 or 4 days. You really don't need any lights because I'm not going to ask you to read scripture with me. I'll read it for you. I'm here to work for you tonight. I'm not selling anything. I'm not meeting you at the door with any demands. What I have for you, I've brought on these little note sheets, and I'm going to give to you freely. That's the most impressive line. That's the best. Tonight, in this auditorium, you shall witness the demise of 2 Amorite kings. It's not going to be pretty. For those of you who are a little squeamish, snuggle up to your husbands. If the husbands are squeamish, there's a special caravan out in the back. One of the very first psalms ever written is not recorded in the book of Psalms. It's recorded in the book of 2 Chronicles. But Chronicles didn't sound very good, so when they did the Psalms, they called it the Psalms. Chronicles is sort of mixed up. But in the Chronicles, we find David writing one of the first psalms. And it is a psalm of instruction. It is a psalm of teaching, where not only is the song sung, but within the song and the melody, the words are instructional words. They teach us what to do with songs and hymns, psalms, poetry, dance, and all the rest of it. And one of the phrases contained in this psalm is celebrate. Celebrate his marvelous deeds. The word celebrate means mark so as to be remembered. Mention, recount. To celebrate means to illustrate, to rehearse, to call attention to in such a fashion that it won't be forgotten. It doesn't say necessarily preach in traditional fashion. It says bring it to people's minds in such a way that it will be marked and remembered. Celebrate it. Demonstrate it. Illustrate it. And I think some of you may be here wondering what all of this hoopla is all about, the dance, the song, the movement, and all the rest of it, the poetry. And what we're really doing is celebrating those things which we really don't want to forget. And we are remembering what He has done in the past, what He is doing in the present, and we are already being lifted up with excitement on account of what He's going to do in the future. We are a celebrating people. And David in his psalm says that there is a legitimate excuse for recounting what He has done in the past in order to encourage us in the present. Concerning the Old Testament deeds of the Lord, we also read in the New Testament that those things were written to us for examples. It really does us well to have rehearsed for us in dance, in drama, in reading, in preaching, in song, and in tents. To have rehearsed for us the deeds of God. And we need to celebrate them and mark them and allow them to become our examples. That's why as I began to discover the army of God afresh and anew, went back into the Old Testament to study battles. Because I found that those battles were really keys to my understanding regarding my identity as a warrior and a battle maker in the army of God. And so I want to share a few choice bits for you concerning some of the first battles that the children of Israel fought as they marched out of the wilderness to take for themselves their inheritance, the promised land. We realize, first of all, that the promised land was not empty. What God has for us to move into is not empty. There's something occupying already that needs to be overcome, that needs to be overwhelmed, that needs to be defeated. In that promised land of that day, there were whole bunches of people who were lumped together and called the Canaanites. Among the Canaanites were the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Perizzites, the Marmites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, the Amorites. God has sent me to England to defeat the Marmites. I brought over a whole bunch of guys to England from the United States last year. And none of them actually could even taste the stuff. Because immediately you opened the jar, most of them left the room. That's not any of my inheritance, I'll tell you that right now. I like the Bible because it's crystal clear. It doesn't leave you in a fog and a haze. It identifies your enemies straightforwardly. The Canaanites represent to us, as a result of the meaning of their name, their Hebrew name, and the construction of their activities, the word Canaanite means to depress. They are looked upon by interpretation, by many scholars and students of the scriptures, as faith killers. They represent to us self-depreciation. They are lowlanders. They dwell in the place of condemnation, depression, and sullenness. When we begin to come into the promised land, we see that the enemies there are faith killers. They're loaded with depression, sullenness, and condemnation. They're good at depressing. Among these Canaanites are such people as the Hittites. The word Hittite means fears. They're negative, gloomy, full of fear. Why do the Hittites need to be driven out of our land? Because there is no fear in our land. And wherever fear exists, we need to raise our swords. We need to enliven our spirits. We need to put on our steel-toed boots. You do that? Our laborers back home wear steel-toed boots. They're required by law in some factories and so on, and they're used for unlawful activities as well. I believe that the Hittites need to feel the effect of the steel-toed boot. Fears need to be driven out of the promised land. The Girgashites. I'm not asking you to repeat anything that I say tonight because I know that some of you will ask to be excused if you say Girgashites. The Girgashites were those who dwelt on clay. The people who inherit the land of God and the inheritance of Jesus are not going to be building their lives on clay. We are not clay dwellers. Those who dwell on clay represent to us worldliness and carnality as a basis for living. The Perizzites, the word Perizzite means unwalled, meaning to us undisciplined, not girded. The Hivites were Midlanders. They represent to us mediocrity, lukewarmness, not high, not low. The Jebusites, a trodden place, much traffic and business, too much activity, preoccupation. Finally, we come to the Amorites. The Amorites were a unique people scattered throughout the land of Palestine, particularly in the highlands. They were called the Highlanders. Among the Amorites were some of the last literal giants, incredibly tall, physically impressive men and women, hefty people. The Amorites, together with their attitudes and their living situation, represent to us a people who are unteachable and independent. These enemies represent to us spirits, demonic and human, attitudes and circumstances. Wherever we run up against these kinds of enemies, whether they are spirits or attitudes or circumstances, they need to be aggressively driven out of my home. They need to be aggressively driven out of your inheritance. In fact, Joshua said concerning these enemies, it is recorded in Joshua, the word was given to him by the Lord, you shall defeat them, you shall utterly destroy them. One of the reasons I find this relevant is because I find elements of Canaanite depression still in existence within the people of God today in whatever church situation they find themselves. Depression is nothing new to the world situation, but seems to have increased in this modern age. Many psychological problems can be traced back to depression. Depression represents to me one of the clearest enemies of our faith, of our land, of our home. They're to be driven out. Tonight, we are going to deal specifically with two Amorite kings, giants, hefty people. And these two specific kings personify the elements of unteachableness and independence. And we find their story recorded in the book of Numbers, chapter 21. I'll read for you these preliminary verses. And Israel sent messengers unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, let me pass through your land. We will not turn aside into the field or into the vineyard. We will not drink of the water of the wells. We will go by the king's highway until we have passed your border. But Sihon would not suffer Israel to pass through his border. And Sihon gathered all his people together and went out against Israel into the wilderness and came to Jahaz. And he fought against Israel. I find Sihon a representative of the Amorite kings. And I find him interesting because as Moses leads the children up from the wilderness, they begin to make their entrance into the promised land. This is just before they cross Jordan. And here's this high-minded challenge. The children of Israel come with meek spirits, cooperative attitudes. And here's a guy who gets on his high horse and says, well, I don't care to have you off-scouring of the earth walking across my land. I don't care how polite your attitudes appear to be. In fact, just out of spite, I think I'll gather my armies and make war against you. Sihon means, in the Hebrew language, tempestuous, suggesting emotional instability. It's a curious thing because although he may represent to us something tempestuous, representing to me at least emotional instability, his capital city, Heshbon, comes from the Hebrew word intelligence or reason, from the root meaning to fabricate, to weave in the mind, to plot or contrive in a malicious sense. Here is a man who, in his very situation in the world, comes from a place having to do with intelligence. To weave in the mind, to contrive, to plot in a malicious sense. He's got an active intellect. It doesn't work for good, but he's got an active mind. Coupled with that active mind is this unusual mixture of emotional instability. I happen to come from the United States, which in recent years has really again left its mark on our generation in regard to a real technological society, developing all kinds of things, active minds in almost every conceivable kind of technological development. Lots of thought. But coupled with this mental activity, I find an unusual blend of widespread emotional instability. For all our intelligence, for all our education, for all of our study, for all of our books, for all of our learning, I find that men and women are not very emotionally stable. And if things don't go their way, they pout, they flout, they lose their tempers, they beat their children, they beat their wives. And there are a number of cases coming to light about husband beating recently as well. People are always beating up on each other back there, and it's becoming widespread. Even though it doesn't take that kind of abuse always, there's lots of verbal abuse. And most of this kind of marital instability, most of this kind of family discord, most of this kind of fractured relationship comes as a result of a very simple kind of emotional instability. When people don't get their way and things don't go conveniently and comfortably, they throw a tantrum. And no one's around with a word of authority and love to set the thing straight. Really, many of our apparently complex problems are not really that complex. They arise out of a simple basis of emotional instability. And I find this unusual marriage back in the Old Testament still exists today. Intelligence and reason and weaving in the mind, coupled with emotional instability. And so we find people who can think about great things and build great things, but who don't know how to live, who don't know how to get along with each other. We find Sihon then marching from his capital city, from Heshbon, to meet the children of Israel. And there is prophetic significance as to where these battles take place. I believe there's a reason why, within the confines of Scripture, we don't find the details of this battle laid forth. Because he gives us the characters in the battle, he gives us the place or the site of the battle, and he gives us the outcome, and that's enough. It speaks for itself. For this emotionally unstable, intelligent man goes to fight against an army of ordinary people at Jahaz, which is interpreted from the Hebrew, the threshing floor. The threshing floor. And at the threshing floor, this man meets his demise, he and his armies with him. The threshing floor represents to me at Jahaz not so much simply a stamping out of existence of this guy, Sihon, with his highfalutin attitude. But it represents to me a judgment which falls upon men and women of reason, a kind of judgment which is meant to separate. Threshing, after all, is not simply to do away with something, but to separate that which is worth keeping and that which is not worth keeping. And there he comes to be judged by the Lord because of his unteachable attitude, his intelligent, emotional attitude, his unteachableness. And I find that Jahaz, a separation from true learning and unteachableness. This means a couple of things to me. It means that before we actually can march into the land and inherit it, we have again to confront the attitude of unteachableness. I can see some of the people with Moses and Joshua sort of saying to themselves, well, didn't we learn that lesson back in the desert? Look, we've been through a lot back there. I went through, all kinds of clothes and sandals and all the rest of it. Here we are, we learned all those lessons. What are we doing here? And I feel that what we need to do now that we have become a body of gifted people, a family, now that we have become a governing force among ourselves, we have again to learn the lesson of teachableness. He is not going to allow us across the river and into his land unless he is sure of the fact that for all that we've experienced together in the wilderness, for all of our corporateness, for all of our leadership, for all of our vision, for all of our faith, he wants to ensure the fact again that the people who go into his land are teachable. Are teachable for all they've learned. We learned to be teachable at the beginning when in fact we knew nothing anyway. But now he wants us again to be judged as teachable after we've learned it, before we employ it, before we express it, before we build it again in the promised land. Yes, we may have learned those lessons before, but he wants to confront us again at Jahaz. And I find that it's too often that that Amorite king still lives within individual believers. And a challenge goes out from heaven, says, right, meet me at Jahaz. Sihon, wherever you are, spirit of Sihon, the circumstance of Heshbon, wherever you exist, the ringing battle cry of the Lord goes out and says, there is a place that I can deal with you. There is a way in which I have prepared for my people to deal with you. You aren't meant to simply exist and exist and go on and dog the feet of God's people. I am going to bring you to a certain place at a certain time, and I'm going to thrash you like you've never been thrashed to the stamping floor of Jahaz. I believe that it's not only true about God's people, where we need to meet him in that place of judgment and separation, where all of our learning is separated again from the attitude of unteachableness and proud high-mindedness. But it is something now that as we go out into the world with our gospel and with our news and with our dancing and with our illustrations and our displays, that we are always going to meet out there this Amorite king, because the world is full of unteachableness. And I think that one of the things we want to learn how to do is to meet that king at Jahaz. We want to learn how to confront the world with its bad attitude. Whenever I speak in schools or colleges or universities, one of the aspects of my testimony that I share with people who are studying and young people who are in schools and sick of it is that what God restored to me was a new love of learning, not necessarily textbook, but learning good things about music and life and marriage and photography and speaking in front of people and relationships and forgiveness and repentance and strength and authority and all the rest of it. I'm learning how to live. And one of the reasons is because he taught me how to learn again. I was unteachable in my former state. And I think that we want to be message bearers to the world, where we meet them at the threshing floor of Jahaz, where we kill the Amorite king wherever he exists, wherever he is still alive. That we who are the sword of the Lord become his demise again in this modern age. Where we are wise enough to expose him for what he is. A high-minded, temperamental giant who can be slain. So that we can restore to people their love of learning. To even have restored to them the simple capability to listen and to hear. They may not agree. They may not fully understand. They may not even like what they're hearing. But at least they've been given somehow a new attitude of learning and hearing. Listening. I think some of the attitudes in younger folks that really, really bothers me the most is the fact that they enjoy people who are glittery and entertaining and forceful and wear fancy clothes and all kinds of things. But when it comes to real serious life, they don't know how to listen. And people haven't taught them how to listen because we don't respect the good things that we need to talk about. I've spoken in marriages back home, and I've talked to the families of those married couples who have gathered to witness these wedding vows. And I've challenged them by saying, you know, folks, we've been able to talk about lots of harmless, benign things in our lives, haven't we? We sit down over coffee, we talk about weather and sports and building costs and mortgage rates. Why is it that we can live our whole lifetime without ever talking about important things? the failure between father and son, husband and wife, and so on and so forth? Why is it those things that mean the most important, that mean the most to us, are the things that we avoid talking about the most often? We're afraid of them. We're intimidated by them. It's because we really have no capacity to listen, to hear, to learn. I say this Amorite king is still alive. And I say that the Lord wants to challenge him again through my life and yours, that wherever we go, we can be the ordinary army of God marching out to challenge him wherever he lives. Sihon, you don't fuss me. Meet me at Jahaz. There's something within inside of my spirit that says, right, I don't know how exactly I'm going to do it, but I know that God has the ability to expose that self-centered fellow for what he is and that kind of an attitude and deal with it in the threshing floor of Jahaz. Meet me at Jahaz. One final guy before we close the evening. The news went out that Sihon was defeated and his land and his capital city was taken, and the children of Israel began to occupy some of these places. Suddenly a great big guy from the north, also an Amorite king, proud, hefty guy, Og of Bashan. News had come to Og, and Og got stirred up about it. He got challenged about it. He had heard about a whole bunch of ordinary people down in Sihon's territory doing all kinds of incredible things. Funny thing about it was, one newspaper account read, they're all wearing leather bomber jackets. What's this? That doesn't fuss me, he says. So he gathers his forces together and he takes his crew and he goes down to challenge the children of Israel. Who is this Og and where does he come from? Og, as we all know, is go backwards. Doesn't take much for us to contrive the meaning of that name, does it? Because here's a guy, for whatever he tried to do, it always ended up going backwards. In fact, the word Og in the Hebrew means round. And with a name like Og, you know he wasn't just a little round. His guy was plump. In fact, also the root round comes from a root that means to gyrate. He was dancing around as well. Actually, Og was a big guy. He was, in fact, one of the last physical giants left in that territory. Later on, as the Israelites mopped up in this campaign and overwhelmed Og and his armies, they took as a trophy of this battle his bed, which was carried with them. And I don't know why they did it, except I think most people wouldn't believe it if they didn't have it before their very eyes. It was a great big metal thing, and he slept in it alone. Just to give you some idea of how big the guy was, it was 13 feet long and 6 feet wide. He was a big dude. He was possessed by the spirit of Texas, I think. Og was a big guy. And if that wasn't enough, he came from the capital city, Ashtaroth, which means to increase. It means accumulation, to grow, to make rich. In fact, one concordance puts it this, to make self wax rich. Who does Og represent to us? What kind of a spirit? What kind of a circumstance? He is a self-centered, materialistic glutton. Also a spirit which seems to be having its heyday in this modern age. He is a self-centered, because his accumulation isn't for the accumulation of the constituents of his kingdom. His accumulation is for himself. Not only was he a big guy in the first place, but he wasn't satisfied just being a big guy. He wanted to be a bigger guy. He wanted to have a big bed. He didn't want to just be round. He wanted to be really round. And he wanted to have possessions that spoke well of his largeness. He wanted to accumulate and make rich himself. He ate, he bought, he fought. He was a big guy and self-centered. And I find it curious that when he met his demise, he met his demise at a little village called Edrei, which construed from the Hebrew simply means enough. Enough. I feel that the battleground of the Lord is significant. That where he meets these characters is significant to us. He meets them in a little village called Enough. Enough. I believe that this little word is significant in two ways. First of all, the Lord sees the self-centered activities of this guy. He's growing larger and larger in more ways than one. And finally, the Lord just simply puts down his hand and says, "That's enough. I'm calling a halt." And here's how the halt comes. I bring my army of ordinary people and stop that guy in his tracks. He may be large. He may have a well-trained army. He may be imposing. He may be intimidating. He may be threatening by his attitude, by his size. But enough is enough. And I believe that one of the simplest things that God can say into this generation of hullabaloo and self-centered accumulation and covetousness and advertising and wanting and buying and desiring is that he can come down and say, "Enough is enough already. Let's call a halt to it." And the halt comes through his people at a little village called Enough. The significance of this village also means this to me. Also quite simple, but I mean, this is where I live. That the people who ended up being the undoing of this hefty Highlander, this literal giant with a big bed, this guy who was huge in everything that he did, this Texan, that the little army of motley people who came up out of the wilderness, who didn't know how to do it, they were enough. They were enough. They weren't big. They weren't well-trained. They weren't professional. They were content with God. They followed him and they were enough. I don't care who you are tonight. You're enough. I don't care how much learning you've been through. I don't care how talented you are. You're enough in the hands of God when he brings you to every eye. His judgment shall issue through you and shall topple that giant. Smite him through and bring his existence to an end. You are enough and you are enough. Have done with simple thinking about yourselves that you are small, tiny, puny, insignificant. You in the hands of our God are enough. Our sounds can overwhelm the sounds of the world's jets and armies. Our doings are mighty, even in their apparent ordinariness. Do you know what we normally tend to think of ourselves? We're not enough. He either needs more numbers, more time, more study, more leaders, more churches. Enough already! If we respond to him and follow him, Og shall fall. But the lesson of Edrei is not simply judgment upon the world around us, but it's also a significant judgment against us. Because I don't think really that Christians know how to be pleased with enough. My ministry in the United States is not very well known, and that doesn't bother me. I don't travel to a great many large cities or centers of conferences. Most of my ministry is involved in farm country, little tiny towns that most people don't have the time or the inclination to visit. I deal with groups of people from 20 on up to 150, 200. People who grow up in little towns and aren't acquainted with what's happening in the large cities, the large universities. And I found early on in my ministry that my desire was to really divulge something of myself to these people. And instead of coming and doing a night's ministry or a rally or even a weekend, my inclination right from the beginning was to come for a week or two or even a month. and to stay in one place with those people for that length of time. And share Bible ministry, but to meet the children, to play football, to eat together, to swim, to do business together, to talk about money, to handle life together, to really commune. Now, most people were a little surprised about that because most ministries in the United States really don't love, I feel, people enough to spend that kind of time. However, instead of being a little bit amazed by that and grateful for it, do you know what the reaction has been in almost every place that I've gone until I stopped it? After spending 2 weeks in some little village that no one else would ever have the time to visit, upon making ready to go home to be with my wife, to be with my friends, after being away for so long, people would come up and say, "Really, we've enjoyed having you for these 2 weeks. Oh boy, maybe next time you can come down and stay longer. Maybe next time you can come down and stay longer." I tell you, you give people 2 days, they want four. Give them five, they want 10. Give them 10. I think that there is something that needs to be spoken into our spirits that creates within us the capability to be satisfied. I don't mean to camp. I don't mean to settle down in such a way that we will stay there forever and never move and never grow, but to be satisfied with what God has given us. I have found that particularly in attitudes toward leaders, people are never satisfied. People are never satisfied. A man can give of his time, a man and his wife, or a woman can give of her time in ministry. And I find that instead of being satisfied with what they get, people want more. And that is a rotten attitude. That is the attitude of Og, of Bashan. And that attitude needs to be slain at a little town called Edrei. We need to meet God in the place that means enough, where we can be grateful to Him for what He has given us and say to Him, "You know, you've given this and it's just enough. I don't crave more. I'm not restless for more. I'm not hungry for more in that restless, wrong kind of unhealthy sense. It's really enough, Father." I find that men and women who are leaders in the church all across my country and even here as I've been here, I find that the pressure is on them to do continually more. And rather than people in churches coming to serve and to take the load off their backs, people are coming to demand. People are coming to want and to expect. And I think sometimes there is a lack of sensitivity on the part of bodies of people toward their leaders and other ministries who come through, not really being sensitive to the kinds of demands upon these lives for time, effort, preparation, and just simple enjoyment. And I think it's a lesson that we have got to learn before we go in to possess fully our inheritance. Og of Bashan really represents to us in his high-minded, rounded, self-centered accumulation, he represents an aspect of independence and unhealthy self-centeredness, of getting rather than giving. And I thank God that the sovereignty of the Lord saw fit to bring him to Edrei, where all self-centeredness ceases. You see, the Lord doesn't mind us wanting to grow. It's this matter of enough that he wants us to learn about. He just wants us to grow enough and be satisfied and content. There's a lovely verse written in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 8, that I'm going to quote for you somewhat in closing here. And this is from a literal translation that I use in study back home. It says this about the grace of God. "Now, God is able to lavish all grace into you. God is able to lavish all grace into you so that, having all contentment in everything always, you may be superabounding unto every good work." Do you know why I find that Christians aren't superabounding unto every good work? It's because they're not content. They are not content. They are forever restless. There is a kind of spiritual hunger that swept the United States alongside the charismatic movement that was not true charismatic. It was charismania. It was meeting monger. It was wanting to make self wax rich spiritually. Everything for my sake. Accumulating vast libraries of every tape ever made, every book ever written, every videotape from every ministry in the States. I have found people literally wax rich in these elements and still not possess the land that God would have them to come into. Have all of these things and still have no vision of what it is to cross Jordan and to drive out the faith killers. I believe that that's a kind of hunger that is restless, self-centered, twisted, and grotesque. It is not true, genuine spiritual hunger. It's still a self-centered lifestyle that God needs to judge at the place that is called enough. I like the fact that what grace lavished into us produces contentment. Having all contentment. I would have been satisfied for Paul to have written that much, all contentment. But he goes on to say in this lovely little phrase, all contentment in everything, always. Those are the kind of people that God will be able to bring into the land and drive out the Canaanites. It's the kind of people who are content in everything. I know that all of us here in this marquee tonight, young and old, rich and poor, from whatever circumstance of life we have come to this place, I know that we are all ignorant in many ways, uninformed. But you know, in spite of the fact that I'm still not full of my humanity and my Christianity, there's something inside of me that is at rest, that is at home, that is sitting on my own personally styled rocking chair, content, smoking a pipe. And for those of you who don't believe in tobacco, it's just got some vegetable herbs in it. So it looks like a pipe and smoke and everything. I'm content. And I'm happy now to grow out of a position of contentment. I'm not restless about the things that I don't know and don't understand and don't see and don't possess. I'm content. That doesn't mean I've driven my stakes and I can't be moved, but every time he says move, I'm going to move in perfect contentment. Because my rocking chair also has a set of wheels underneath. I just press a button and it sort of moves along and I continue rocking. I'm content. Do you know what contentment means? It means that you can go to meetings like this all over England and hear preaching that disagrees with everything you've ever been taught by your local leaders and never be fussed one iota. It might be true. But you see, I find that Christians are too easily disturbed. They're too easily intimidated and threatened by other teaching or other ministries. I'm content. I'm open. And what I have. And if he wants to change it, he'll change it in contentment. And if he wants to take me on, you know why Og was so dumbfounded by these guys who came up in their bomber jackets? Because they also came up in rocking chairs and pipes. Og came into Edrei to do battle, and there they all were sitting on their rocking chairs saying, "Hey, how's it going? Rally time." The one thing I covet for you as the body of Christ, in whatever your circumstance as a Christian, is that you be content. And if you're not content in everything always, there's something of God's grace that is not being lavished into you. Put to end the restlessness and the twisted form of hunger that Og of Bashan represents to us, that kind of self-centeredness, and be content with what you have. And what you do possess that God has given you, glorify it. Call attention to it and say, "It's enough for me." And I think the reason that we can go around happy is because what he's done to us is always enough. I've got enough, thank you. I think some of you, especially the Irish guys, when I'm camping out at the campsite out there, always asking for seconds. They're sort of never have enough. "Can I have 2 potatoes, please?" Then there are the rest of us on our rocking chairs. "I've had enough, thank you." I really would appreciate the fact that we can grow and change from a position of contentment. Page 3. I believe that we need to defeat Sihon utterly. I believe that we need to slay this king from Bashan, Og, utterly. Mind you, what we've shared here tonight, this isn't the main event. They haven't even crossed Jordan and gone into the land yet. These are preliminary battles. Why, if you want to come to the United States and see Muhammad Ali fight in just a month or so, this is just a preliminary battle. This isn't even the main event. The main event is yet to take place. This is a preparatory battle. And it is meant to be a preparation by means of judgment and separation, where we are confronted again with the attitudes of unteachableness and independence and self-centeredness, and where God's people see again the seriousness of these enemies and deal with them utterly before we go in to inherit the land. If there are ever things that I've discovered in my Christian life that would prevent you from entering into your find, your possession, your personal promised land as a believer, it's these two Amorite kings. I say, let's get them. I say, let's do them in and rock our ways to heaven. All right? I appreciate your patience tonight. It's been a little bit lengthy. It's after 10. I know that we haven't probably taken up the offering yet either. So we'll see if you can be content for a few minutes more while Gerald comes and wraps things up. My prayer for you is that wherever you meet these kings, in yourselves or in the world around you, that you know how to slay them wisely and that you deal with them fully, completely, and utterly. And so that you can live in true kingdom life with the contentment that comes from the grace of God. Bless you. Good night. Amen.